Hi, everyone. I'm Mark Lee. I'm the director of the ERM Sustainability Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this latest episode of the Sustainable Connections podcast. If you're at all a regular listener, you know that we try to reach out into the world and connect with people who are doing the kind of collaborative and partnership-based work that we think is necessary to solve the big systemic sustainability challenges. And today is absolutely no exception. I've got two colleagues with me on the line today. I'll be speaking with the CEO of the Global Renewables Alliance, Bruce Douglas. Bruce, hello.
Hey, Mark. Great to be here. Thank you.
Great. So good to have you. And also with my own ERM colleague, Dylan Mitchell. And Dylan is the Global Commercial Director for Renewables inside ERM.
Hi, Mark. Thanks a lot for inviting me.
Excellent. Well, it's nice to have you here. And I want to give the audience a chance to get to know each of you a tiny bit. So the slight sort of oblique angle on the question I'd like to ask you is, how did you end up in your current role? And what's a motivator in it? What's the fun? What's the challenge? You know, what's got you doing the work that you do? And Bruce, I'll ask you to explain that first.
So, I mean, the how actually is linked to the why, Mark. I mean, why I do it. My life purpose is to electrify everything that can be electrified with renewable energy. So it's 25 years I've been working in renewable energy now in various different sectors, mainly in the advocacy space, so lobbying for renewable energy. We've been looking to collaborate on various renewable technologies for a long time. I've worked in wind, I've worked in solar. And when Ben Backwell from the Global Wind Energy Council approached me and said he'd set up this Global Renewables Alliance and would I like to lead it, so I jumped at the chance. It really is going back to your point about collaboration and partnership to get this done. And this is the perfect example of that. So the Global Renewables Alliance brings together the global wind, solar, geothermal, hydro, long duration storage, and green hydrogen into one single entity. So we speak with one voice for the renewables industry internationally. And I think that's the powerful piece. Our strapline is together for a clean future. And it genuinely is working together to unlock and accelerate the energy transition. And I suppose my passion in it and my purpose is obvious, but also it's a lot of fun. Really enjoy it. So that's how I came to be here.
Oh, awesome. It's a great answer to hear. And it must be so satisfying to have a longtime purpose like that come into a role like this that feels like such a match. Dylan, you have a high bar to reach now to tell us why you're so satisfied with your role at ERM as well, but let's hear it.
Yeah, it's definitely a high bar. So yeah, I'm representing the sort of 400 people that work in renewables in ERM. And I guess for most of us, it is that piece about how do we help fight climate change. And I've been working in the renewable space for about 12 years. And so it's always been about how do we, you know, reduce emissions and we build, you know, the products that will allow us to do that. But I think in my time in the industry, I think it is that question of collaboration that's really sort of driven where I've been moving towards. And it's a comment from our comms director, which I really like. And I don't know if it works in an English accent, but he always says, you know, we used to be green business, but now we mean business. And I really like it. You know, it's talks about the scale of what we need to do. And I think it is that scale that I think has brought me into ERM. If we do our jobs correctly and we do install enough renewable power for us to keep climate change from going beyond the 1.5 degrees, you know, we will be big business. We will be out there. We will have a huge impact on the world. And I think this is, to quote someone maybe a little bit more famous than our comms director, it's that Stravinsky quote of, you know, good composers borrow, great composers steal. And ERM, you know, has a proud history of solving these problems already. A lot of these problems have already been solved in, you know, in the dirty industries, as we call them, in the oil and gas, in the coal industry, in the mining industry, and so on. And so it's how do we bring in these learnings of, you know, how do we work with stakeholders? How do we work with communities at that massive scale that we will need to be in 2050? And so it is that two part. In the short term, how do we build enough that we maintain, you know, the 1.5 degrees? But then as we build at that sort of scale, these projects we build today will still be running in 2050. So how do they then make sure that we're actually making the world a better place then? So it's, you know, doing enough to make a difference and then doing enough to leave a good legacy.
Yeah, there's a lot of weight on all of our decisions, right? Knowing how long the infrastructure we put in play now is going to run. And I find it amazing and encouraging. People listening may or may not know there are about 8,000 people in ERM in total now. And every time I hear that we've got 400 of them, you know, that big a percentage working almost exclusively on renewables. I'm kind of stunned and pleased and proud. So great to have you, Dylan. Great to have you, Bruce. Appreciate the intros. Let's kind of plunge into our conversation today. And we're obviously going to focus on work that's going on within the Global Renewables Alliance and work that ERM does in parallel to that. So we'll get more specific as we go. But Bruce, maybe just to open up, we're recording this on the eve of COP28. You know, so I wanted to talk about global ambitions and targets for a couple of minutes to at least frame things up. Just kind of where are we? And if we state what we know, you know, governments, business, and society share both the clarity and the accountability to deliver the ambition of the Paris Agreement. We're just sort of receiving the results of the global stocktake, the first one under that Paris process, and the evidence tells us everything we feared, right? That we are not on course to deliver and to hold warming to 1.5 degrees C or really possibly anything close to that. So what would you say we need to do to change this? And how big of a role is renewables going to play in the change?
You know, when you add up the NDCs, the national determined contributions, so each country's, you know, piece towards that 1.5 degree pathway, we're not close to where we should be. And so that's why we as the Global Renewables Alliance announced this tripling of renewables combined with the doubling of energy efficiency rates to really try and get us back on track. I mean, this is going back to the IRENA World Energy Transition Outlook earlier this year, which modeled what would be needed to stay on track to 1.5, you know, tripling of renewables and doubling of energy efficiency were the two most important steps that governments could take to get us back on track. You know, it's a credible model piece of work. We also aligned with IEA now, Ember, and many others on this similar figure. So it's at least 11,000 gigawatts by 2030. Cumulative renewable energy installed globally. That's what's required in the tripling. Now, doubling, given the current growth rate of renewables, which is significant, doubling is now inevitable. So to something like 8,000 gigawatts. It's the gap between 8,000 and 11,000 that's the key and the most difficult, of course. And to put it in perspective, to reach that 11,000 gigawatts, it would require something like 3 gigawatts per day, every day between now and 2030. Built and connected. So, you know, if you know what 3,000 megawatts of renewables looks like, you'll understand the challenge. We'll come on to it later about, you know, what needs to be done. But your question was, what can renewables do? We can deliver. You know, the industry, we say, yes, we can. We've stood up and said, we'll commit to that. But there needs to be urgent action on behalf of the governments to get this done. Finance, permitting, grids, and supply chains mainly. There was good signs. You say, you know, who's doing what? I mean, there are good signs. There's a lot of high ambition countries out there. The European Union, some of the African states, even Southeast Asia and LATAM have shown countries that are bucking the trend, let's say, and going beyond the tripling. And in the recent Africa Climate Summit Nairobi Declaration, they said, you know, they're going to go fivefold. And I'll just end with our sort of strap line on this. You said ambition and accountability. Well, we'll add the third A, which is action. So the ambition is the target. You know, you don't reach a goal without setting a target. I think we all understand that. But that's all it is. It's just a target. So then you need action from the governments on those enablers. And finally, accountability. So some sort of measurement, monitoring, and reporting system to show the progress annually towards the target.
I like the third A. We'll take it and we'll make it a part of our ongoing conversations too, to keep pledging the action. Bruce, one tiny thing, you know, you said if you know what 3,000 gigawatts looks like, and let's assume that a bunch of our listeners actually don't. So on a per diem basis to close that gap or to get to the total, can you give us an equivalency, what that much power looks like and what it delivers?
Well, I could give you the equivalent in terms of a wind turbine. You know, let's say the average wind turbine onshore now is like 3 megawatts. Well, it's 1,000 of those built and connected every day. So I think, you know, that puts it in perspective. Obviously, that's not in one place. That's around the world. You know, it's a significant challenge. It comes with significant benefits. Once this done, this is a one-off transition as well. And by, you know, by mid-century at the latest, this energy transition, it'll bring such significant benefits and such a cost reductions for end consumers, new jobs, clean air, and secure power. So secure and affordable power, it's a huge win-win.
Yeah, lots of direct climate benefits and lots of peripheral or related benefits as well. And I can picture that 1,000 turbines a day, and it is staggering. You inevitably end up with them sort of all lined up in your head. It gives a sense of the scale. Bruce, you mentioned IRENA and of course, the Global Renewables Alliance and IRENA recently released a report kind of setting out the how are we going to do this in terms of tripling renewable power and doubling energy efficiency. And back at New York Climate Week, you launched a campaign. ERM happily is signatory to that in terms of accomplishing that part of the action. Just for a moment, let's talk about the doubling down on energy efficiency part. And how important is the energy efficiency element to achieving net zero goals? In a way, this seems like the obvious part, right? And so what's keeping it from happening?
Well, first of all, thanks a lot to ERM for supporting the movement. And, you know, that open letter is still open on our website for those companies or organizations who want to support that call to government to set a target. But you're right, the energy efficiency is a tricky one. And, you know, partly because it's not that sexy, you know, it's not tangible like wind turbines are. It's hard to finance energy efficiency, much more difficult from a project finance point of view to do that. But it is absolutely critical. Now, although the Global Renewables Alliance will not be working on that actively, I mean, our focus is on the supply side of renewables, it's a critical mm-hmm. piece. And the reason is because power demand is increasing dramatically at the same pace almost as renewables is increasing. And so because of electrification of transport, you know, EVs, but also, you know, end use sectors generally, heating, industry sectors, electricity demand is going to keep on increasing. And if you don't use less energy and use it smarter, so efficiently, then you end up still having to build fossil fuels. Yeah. So if we really want to phase down and ultimately phase out fossil fuels, then you need that crucial energy efficiency piece in parallel to growing the renewable energy.
Yeah, we've just got to get better at using all the energy we have, regardless source, at the same time as this incredible scaling of renewables, right? You mentioned where I'd like to go next, Bruce. You talked about the finance piece, and I do want to move from the energy efficiency aspect, the doubling energy efficiency, to the tripling renewables, which is obviously more the GRA's focus. And maybe I can draw you out a bit more, Bruce, on the current state of access to finance for renewable energy projects. Is there enough money on the table? Where is it coming from? What more needs to be done to unlock access to the necessary funds to get the job done?
So renewable energy, just to be clear, is cost competitive with fossil fuels in almost all markets around the world now. You know, that cost reductions have been dramatic and may well continue, but we don't think they need to. We think they really are cheap enough now to compete with fossil fuels. But it's the access to finance you rightly point to. We don't burn fuel like coal or oil or gas in renewables. We burn capital. We need access to capital. And in developed markets, there's enough capital. Well, in fact, there's enough capital globally. But especially in emerging markets and developing economies, the cost of capital is 2, 3, even 5 times what it is in developed markets. And that's a huge issue. And it comes from, you know, country risk, investment risk, currency risk, and also inflation has had its effect. So what we're looking for is, we're not looking for subsidies. Let's be clear. We're actually asking for, you know, the removal of fossil fuel subsidies mm-hmm. and the pivot financial flows to go from fossils to renewables, but not necessarily in subsidies. What we ideally need is long-term signals, you know, the long-term investment signals. In many emerging markets, we do need concessionary financing. So we need, as I say, access to that low-cost capital. Then it'll get built. The industry is ready to build. We think the money's there, but it's that it's changing the business models and the financial systems to mobilize that investment into renewables. And they tend to be quite decentralized. They tend to be low risk, low return, instead of high risk, high return fossil fuel. So it's quite a different financing model. And that's the change we need to see in the international financial institutions. So, you know, the World Bank, the IMF, the development banks generally have a huge role to play here, especially in the global south and those emerging markets.
Perfect. And Dylan, I think this is part of your everyday brief, right? And maybe you can take us a little farther down the financing path. What are some examples of the financing tools that are being used? And maybe Bruce has said out already that there's different risk, at least different perceived risk in different regions. Where are those perceptions coming from? How do we overcome them with some of these approaches and tools so that we can get funding everywhere that it needs to go?
I think Bruce covered most of the sort of big risk drivers that we're seeing in the developing world there. And it is tougher in, you know, in the recent past with increasing inflation, increasing interest rates and so on. And so that cost differential, we do see it increasing. But we have actually worked with some of those development banks, for example, on how do they actually de-risk these markets. So looking at, you know, understanding really what is the policy, legal, regulatory frameworks that they're operating in, providing that clarity to the market so that they're able to actually understand these risks more clearly, you know, understanding what best practice is in regards to tendering in these markets so that we can actually then, you know, ensure that best practice is followed so these global players can go in with a clear understanding of what's going on. When you look at these developed markets, just due to the number of projects they have there, you know, a lot of the mapping, the geospatial mapping, the resource assessments and so on have already been done in these markets. So actually using some public funding or actually working with our private clients as well, we can actually go into these markets, map out what is the wind speed in this market and so on. So you can actually then understand, increase the bankability of your projects, reduce the cost of finance. We also have to, of course, do a huge amount to reduce this perceived risks in understanding, okay, what are the local stakeholders? What are some of these environmental and social risks that potentially could be there in the market? Helping the regulators to actually build these transparent models for actually setting up permitting and so on, so people can actually understand what other clients, other developers have done in the past. So there's a number of different ways we do this. We work with both, the private sector and also with these development banks and regulators to sort of increase the bankability. And there is still a huge role to be played by public finance. As we do more and more of this, it increases the ability of private capital to move into these markets and for these projects to be built.
You know, you talked about de-risking and you talked about increasing bankability. It makes it sound like at least part of this is shifting the perception of these projects. And is that a fair way to express it? And can you give us an example of a project in a place this has successfully happened?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think you are right. It is a lot of this is about the perception. It is about mobilizing finance, mobilizing multiple actors so that they all feel comfortable at the same time to move into a market. Once the ball is rolling, then things do move much more efficiently. In terms of an example project, I mean, a great one is the work the World Bank is doing in offshore wind. They have an offshore wind development program where they're working with a number of countries around the world, helping them to build a roadmap and a framework for actually how do you build your first projects? What should the policy framework look like? What does best practice look like? Can they find support from, you know, best-in-class technical resources, so people that can go in and support the regulator to assess, you know, these global parties coming on board? Can they understand, you know, where do you best place your projects? Where is the grid availability there? These initial grid studies, where is the supply chain there? What ports and infrastructure requirements are going to be in the market? So we supported the World Bank, I think, in Vietnam recently on their roadmap. We've also worked in various other regions around the world on this. And by helping these governments and these regulators to really understand, you know, what does a modern offshore wind roadmap look like? What is required in terms of the resources? What is best practice look like today? We help them to understand, to build their own market in such a way that is encouraging for these developers to move into.
You gave me yet another pivot, Dylan, there. You threw into your finance answer a bit on grids. And Bruce, maybe I'm going to bring this back to you. That we need financing to develop the projects at kind of the front end stage. But it's a whole further question once we have power available to get it to market. So grids and infrastructure, where are we? How big is the gap? And just how would you describe the current state of capacity to deliver the power being developed to the markets where it's needed?
Yeah, Mark, it's a long way off where it needs to be. And there's been some really good recent reports out of the IEA, out of Eurelectric, showing exactly the state of where we're at. And there's such a huge way to go. As you said, one challenge is financing and building the renewables, and the next, the big one, is to connect them. Something like 1,000 gigawatts of projects across Europe and North America are waiting for connection. And that would take us a long way towards the 11,000 by 2030. And it has to be at the transmission and distribution level. Something like 70% of the new renewable energy capacity will be connected at the distributed level, so decentralized renewables. Also taking into account that in many global south countries, emerging markets, There's a lot of rural communities where mini grids and even off-grid solutions need to be taken into account. So there's a whole range of grid connections needed. Combine that with the fact that we need smarter grids, we need digitalization of grids in order to make this transition as smooth and efficient as possible. So there's huge advantages to the new grid systems being put in place, but huge challenges as well. There's millions of kilometers of power lines need to be put in at sea for offshore wind, but also on land to connect the power to the consumers. And this is something we need to start working on now, because this takes years to get in place. So if we want any action by 2030, alongside renewable development, we do need the grid infrastructure development as well.
And Dylan, can you pick this up? I know that, you know, ERM's often brought on board in part to solve for this problem. So where are you seeing some examples of how we accelerate the development and acceptance of grid and infrastructure to get the power where it needs to go?
Yeah, the grid is a real issue for us. And we have seen, you know, investment in renewables really rising rapidly, but we haven't actually seen that in the grid, and we do need it to move in parallel. And so there are projects where we've seen routes changed. So for example, a project I've worked on in Germany, the SüdLink project, we moved from a overhead cable project, which was started in 2012, having to be spent 3 years in design before actually, due to stakeholder concerns, moving it to a buried cable project. So using 3 years of time to build a project, which is then actually having to go through a complete redesign. And this has long-term effects. So we've moved from a 2022 expected installation date to 2028. So moving this power, which is so in need in the south of Germany, from projects which are being built and being consented in the north down to the south, being delayed by this 6 year period, it really has an impact on the energy transition. And so what we do really is to try to identify these issues way in advance of the project getting to that stage. So we speak to stakeholders, we understand the issues, we understand the biodiversity concerns, the environmental concerns, the social concerns in the local areas, and we help to build the projects or make sure these projects are built on time. Having said that, this is for these big long-term transition projects, but there are other factors we can take which allow projects to move quicker in the immediate future. So there are things we can do today. So looking at the Dutch model, in the Dutch auctions for offshore wind, they have actually included some criteria for system integration. So ensuring that electrons are being delivered to where they're needed, when they're needed, has some value in the auction criteria. And so it's not purely based on price. It's also based on these other issues. Other things that we're seeing a lot of and we're helping our clients with is really modeling power to X solutions. So understanding, okay, if there is no grid available in the short term, are there other revenue streams which allows us to still get these wind turbines or these solar projects working in advance of that? And so we're looking at things like battery storage. We're looking at things like hydrogen as a stopgap until the grid is available.
Obviously, underpinning so much of this is pure creativity, but also listening, right? That being responsive to those communities, solving for their problems, being able to solve for them in ways that don't lead to 6 year delays in the future, we hope. But ultimately that grid and its development and the construction has to suit the people that it's going to serve. I don't at all want this to sound like we're just identifying the problems, but there are lots of challenges. So let's say we're exploring the challenges, and Bruce, I'd love to come now to policy and permitting. And you know, we need permission to do this. We're looking for supportive policy that will help accelerate the development of renewables. Is that what's happening? You and Irena, again, recently published another report, Offshore Wind Scale-Up, Innovations in Permitting. It's not always a place we think about innovation. What does that look like even, and is it working?
Yeah, absolutely. We need innovation in permitting. I mean, we just simply need acceleration. I'll touch on four things that can be done by governments to accelerate, or even local authorities to accelerate permitting. One is standardization. So if I was a project developer for wind, then you need to submit, you know, the planning application for permits in each country. And it differs dramatically from country to country, which documents you have to provide, under which timeframes, under which legislation. So some level of standardization would certainly help. This linked to that is digitalization as well. So digitizing the permitting process would not necessarily accelerate the process, it could, but it, more importantly, it allows more projects to be submitted and responded to in the same time. The second is one-stop shops. So there's multiple authorities that you need to submit the applications to. And Denmark is a good example, Dylan, actually, where you are, where the offshore wind now is under one authority. There's a one-stop shop for all those applications, simplifying the process. The third is acceleration, simply, you know, decreasing the timelines that authorities are given to authorize projects. Currently, it can take longer to permit a project than it can to build one, which is frankly insane. Yeah, in a world where we're trying to get renewables built. And the final one is sort of cross-sectoral collaboration. Again, going back to that word, you know, maritime spatial planning is one. So offshore, working with fishermen and other marine users to make sure that the permitting and planning is in place in the best possible way, efficiently, but also as fast as possible.
Yep. So hearing kind of a five rules almost, standardize, digitize, if I take one stop as simplify and collaborate. And Dylan, I'm going to ask you to expand on the collaboration part. Where are there best practices that we can learn from in terms of collaboration across the parties involved in renewables to accelerate and scale the renewable power we need?
We recently released an internal report for a client looking at best practice or in terms of permitting as a whole. And this collaboration piece was on our list of five as well. And for us, that collaboration, it's really about the open, transparent communication. We do see digital as a key part of that as well. So being able to actually openly share information. And we see this transparency bring in a few different benefits. We see when a developer is looking to build a project and they know clearly what other developers have done in that sector to be successful. This speeds up the process for everyone. It allows other stakeholders to understand, okay, what is best practice in a given market? And it does raise the overall level of everyone involved in the market. So we do think that this is something that does bring a lot of benefit. Or we do also see a clear appeals process to be something that actually does increase the benefits as well. So giving people the right to appeal against decisions that they disagree with, although it seems like something that would slow down processes, it does in fact increase the speed. It gives people a real off-ramp for them to engage with the projects constructively. So this is something that also really helps. I think that single one-stop shop piece that Bruce spoke about earlier as well, having a single point, does it also increase that sort of collaboration, that one person that the developer knows that they go out to, they share the knowledge internally within the regulator. This does seem to also increase both collaboration, but also the speed of permitting for these projects.
Yep. Thanks, Dylan. And I'm going to stick with you, Dylan, but with another topic. And, you know, this whole conversation is framed in a context of tripling renewables by 2030, which is effectively tomorrow, right? 2023 is almost over. And anytime we talk about tripling anything where there are materials and manufacturing involved, we're actually talking about supply chains. And if we're going to triple something of that scale that fast, it just screams a need for supply chain resiliency and capacity building. Are these supply chains ready? You know, can we triple renewables using the systems we've got, or are we also redesigning and reinventing the whole renewable supply chain as we charge towards 2030 and this goal?
No, it's a really good question. And I think the supply chain is quickly becoming one of the bottlenecks for us. And I think it does point to that middle A that Bruce was talking about of action. So I think the targets are there. Despite these targets, though, manufacturers pulling out of markets right now, both of the major manufacturers in the US talking about the supply roadmap and not being clear enough for them to make investment decisions on building factories. And we do need to build factories globally in all regions around the world. We need to be investing. I think the challenge here is, again, it's about this collaboration piece. It's about how do we bring together the various stakeholders, the project developers, the regulators, so they have a clear understanding of what they want and where they want these factories to be built. Local content requirements do confuse matters. You know, a lot of these facilities are too big to be built on single projects. And unfortunately, right now, we have a situation where the developers are the pioneers for these projects. So we have developers who are brilliant pioneers. They go into markets, they build things for the first time. But just like the pioneers, once they built these things, then they're back in their wagons and they're off again to the next market. And it's unfortunately the manufacturers that need to stay there, that need to have a business case which lasts for 10, 15 years. And unfortunately, right now, they don't have the clarity to invest in these long-term factories. So we do see solutions to this, of course. I think, you know, we do need regional collaboration, again, to solve this topic. often a single market, a single country isn't enough to sustain a factory. So we need, you know, multiple parties coming together, explaining how local content potentially can be shared across multiple communities, across multiple countries. Between them, we think this may ensure that we're building enough that everyone will do well and we'll have a supply chain which supports, you know, thousands of good jobs around the world.
Now, it sounds like lots to do, but actually hopeful in terms of the progress being made and the understanding being developed. Bruce, sticking with supply chains for just another minute before we maybe head towards a wrap up. We've been talking more about environmental and technical and logistical things so far today, as much as we've talked about the social elements of anything to do with renewables. It's maybe been more community focused and how communities are engaged in siting or development issues. But human rights are an issue in renewable supply chains also. Can you spend a moment describing to us how serious a challenge that is and what's being done to overcome and improve working conditions for the people in these supply chains as well?
Yeah, now that's an important topic. We want to make sure that we don't make the same mistakes the fossil fuel industry has made, you know, whether it's in the factories themselves manufacturing or, you know, mining. I mean, there's been a recent report showing that, you know, the impact even, you know, in 2030, 11,000 gigawatts is significantly less than the impact of fossil fuels, the mining sector. But also, you know, let's take, for example, human rights in factories. We've been working very closely with solar industry in China, Southeast Asia, and the wind industry globally to make sure. And I think, you know, we can be very pleased with the progress. Of course, we've got to keep an eye on it. We do not want to slip back into any risk of that happening. You know, it's pretty clear that the renewable energy industry is focused and is doing everything possible to eliminate rights abuses from the manufacturing of renewables.
Bruce, I started you off with a question about the state of global ambition and where we are on the eve of COP28. When I think about the entire COP process, not just this year, it all depends on international collaboration, just like tripling renewables. And so I think want to ask Bruce, are you hopeful as we head into Dubai? And how would you characterize the chances of collective action on the ground there, leading to any kind of breakthrough, frankly, on renewables or any other part of this agenda?
Yeah, so COP is probably not the place for, you know, a significant collective action. And, you know, we shouldn't raise our expectations too high. Having said that, I mean, we as the Global Renewables Alliance are cautiously optimistic that, well, first of all, renewables will get a lot of discussion, a lot of visibility, and acknowledgement that is one of the, if not the most critical elements to accelerate to stay on track for 1.5 degrees. And so those discussions are happening now. And going back to my three A's, you know, the ambition is being set. The COP28 presidency is setting a pledge. And hopefully, you know, significant number of countries will sign up to that pledge for tripling and doubling. Action is starting to be taken by many countries. You've seen that in the European Union, some African countries, Southeast Asia. There's some leaders, some champions, as we call them, who are going beyond the tripling and showing that it's possible in very different locations. And finally, accountability. So we need that, the post-COP piece, which is, okay, how can we monitor and measure this going forward and make sure that we do stay on track? Thanks a lot, Mark.
Yeah, no, the accountability piece, the keeping our promises part is so incredibly important, right? Dylan, similar question to you. What are your expectations that this COP will lead to an acceleration on renewables? Maybe there are particular types of solutions that you're hoping will get a boost or that we'll see move forward fastest, whether that's some of the stuff we talked about today, grids or infrastructure or policy or anything else. What's your view of what lies ahead?
I think similar to Bruce, I think COP is definitely great meeting point for a lot of our clients and a lot of our industry partners and government partners. So I wouldn't want to put too much pressure on a single meeting, but I do think it is a place where we can take stock and see where we are. And I think the positive thing for us as ERM is how many of our clients are engaging with us as a renewables company at this conference. A number of our clients who we would typically not see as renewables clients, so our mining clients or our technology clients or our clients in the finance sector, are really approaching us and trying to understand how now to use renewables as a part of their decarbonization strategy. And And so this for me is the big positive that we can talk to a mining client about, you know, what does the increased demand for commodities mean for them and how do they decarbonize their own actions using renewable power? And so suddenly renewables is really the center point of that. And they're being engaged in a lot of these conversations on permitting because they are interested, even as a mining company, how do they permit their renewables projects so that they can supply themselves faster? When we speak to these large tech companies about their data centers, how do they ensure that they are going to get clean and reliable source of green power to power their data centers? So there's a huge number of clients which we historically would not have engaged on the topic of renewables who are today, you know, really speaking to us about this topic and making it a center point for our engagements, which is a positive sign of where, you know, the private sector is moving right now. So I think more than anything, I'm hoping that this is a chance for us to talk to our clients about all of these broad topics, but also to really center renewables as a key part of how we'll solve this climate change issue.
Yeah, I love that as a path out of our conversation today, Dylan, that we kind of close on the notion that renewables do not belong to any particular sector, but rather they are economy-wide, and whatever sector or industry a company might be in, they need to figure out what role renewables play in their future as well. As we wrap up, I want to say a deep thanks to both of you, Bruce and Dylan. It's been a real pleasure to have this conversation. Appreciate your time and your insight both. And for those of you listening, we always appreciate you giving us your time and your ears. The Sustainable Connections podcasts are all found on erm.com. as well as more information about our organization. You can also find the podcast and listen to them on your preferred podcast platform. Thanks so much for being with us today. Thanks again, Bruce and Dylan. And we will watch closely to see how the double efficiency, triple renewables pledge moves forward from here to 2030. And we'll do more than watch. We will cheer and support and hope that that does come to pass in the way that we need it to. All for now.